This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Perhaps you've seen the movie 84 Charing Cross Road. The title comes from the famous antiquarian bookstore, which was located at that London address. My guest, Leo Marx, grew up in the bookstore, which was owned by his parents. He went on to write the screenplay for the cult classic Peeping Tom, which is currently on the art house circuit with a restored print. His new memoir, Between Silk and Cyanide, is about his work during World War II as one of the British Army's top code makers. He was the director of codes for the SOE, the Special Operations Executive, which was charged with sending agents to infiltrate enemy-occupied territory. When Marx entered the military, agents' secret messages were encoded into poems. Some agents preferred to use poems by famous writers. Others used poems that were written for them. Although Marx thought the poem code was vulnerable and eventually replaced it, he wrote a now famous poem that was used as code. I asked him to read it.
The life that I have is all that I have, and the life that I have is yours. The love that I have of the life that I have is yours and yours and yours. A sleep I shall have, a rest I shall have, yet death will be but a pause for the peace of my years in the long green grass will be yours and yours and yours.
Now, how was a code passed along in a poem?
An agent would be given a poem, and it would vary in length, and he'd choose 5 words from that poem. He'd show us by an indicator system which 5 words they were, and then he'd give each letter of those words a number and then jumble up the letters of his message and send them to us in a jumbled order. But if the Germans intercepted that message and broke it, they could mathematically reconstruct the 5 words of the poem which he'd used. And if he'd used a famous poem, as one poor devil did, God save the king, the Germans would know the rest of the poem, and they needn't break any more messages in order to read his back traffic. So, whilst trying to change the entire system, I made a rule that as many poems as possible should be original compositions, so that at least if the Germans broke a message, we'd hold them up a little because they wouldn't know the rest of the words.
Is there a story that you had always wanted to share but you didn't feel at liberty to until now?
Yes, many. The most important of all I was finally able to share in this book, and it's about a brilliant, brilliant general of ours called Templar. Because a lot of people think that Britain doesn't take many major liberties in war and stick strictly to the rules. This man was a rule breaker, and he wanted to give the impression of a German resistance movement in Germany where none existed. And he instructed me to devise a code book that could be found in Germany to suggest that we had an active resistance movement there. What he didn't tell me till much later was that the code book was to be found on the body of a dead double German agent who would be killed whilst parachuting, and that I would have to brief this man with complete sincerity before he left. That was one of the major deception operations in the war. And strangely, a lot of people have doubted it and said Britain would never do that. Well, I received a letter just about 3 months ago from someone who'd read the book and was delighted to say he was the man instructed by General Templar to mount this operation by devising a parachute that would not open. And he then had to report to the general. Sir, this can't be done. They detect something wrong. And the general cut him short and said the whole thing's been stopped because it's against the policy of prisoners of war. But he did not say that to me. And the question has always remained, was Sachinop mounted? And finally, we are in sight of the truth. It has been a relief to tell that. I disliked briefing a man who was going to be killed.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Leo Marx, and he's written a memoir about World War II when he was the head of codes for Britain's Special Operations Executive. And he's written a new memoir about that called Between Silk and Cyanide, A Codemaker's War. Leo Marx also wrote the screenplay for the film Peeping Tom, and his father ran the bookstore at 84 Charing Cross Road. Code making seems like the perfect job for you since you were brought up appreciating language. Your father owned Marx & Company, the famous antiquarian bookstore at 84 Charing Cross Road in London, the bookstore that was the subject of a book and a subsequent film adaptation. Would you describe the store?
I never learnt language except the language of the cash register. It was a highly commercial business. And I was the only son of two partners, Marx and Cohen, who thought it would be better to call it Marx and Co. than Marx and Cohen. And Dad had decided 3 months before I was born.
Was that for anti-Semitic reasons? I mean, for fear of anti-Semitism?
Anti-Semitism and general style. They thought Marx and Co. sounded better. Yes, fundamentally anti-Semitism. But it was B. Marx and M. Cohen. Hmm. And every Saturday morning at the age of eight, I was taken into that store and instructed in the price of books. Nothing to do with the content or the quality, just the price.
Now, you write in your memoir that your favorite section of your father's bookstore was the occult section. Why were you interested in the occult?
Fundamentally, because it helps when you're breaking codes. If you become interested in unconscious communication, you believe in it or you don't. You think you can pick up thoughts that other people are not expressing, and possibly they yours. And I learned a form of two-way communication in 84 Charing Cross Road that was years later to be invaluable in SOE when we were fighting to win the war of the resistance movement codes.
My guest is Leo Marx. His new memoir is called Between Silk and Cyanide. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Leo Marx. He's the author of a new memoir about his experiences during World War II as the head of codes at England's Special Operations Executive. He also wrote the screenplay for the 1960 movie Peeping Tom, which was re-released by Martin Scorsese a few years ago and is now on the art house circuit. It's about a young man who makes his living taking girly photos to be sold under the counter, but his obsession is making movies of women as he murders them. The young man is a victim of the experiments his scientist father did on him as a child.
He wanted a record of a growing child. Complete. In every detail. Such a thing were possible. And he tried to make it possible by training a camera on me at all times. I never knew, the whole of my childhood, one moment's privacy. He was interested in the reactions of the nervous system to fear.
Fear?
Fear. Especially fear in children and how they react to it. I think he learned a lot from me. I'd wake up sometimes screaming. He'd be there, taking notes and pictures. And I'm sure good came of it for some people.
I asked Leo Marx to describe his inspiration for Peeping Tom.
Peeping Tom was conceived whilst briefing agents in Baker Street. Because I was convinced that cryptographers, code makers, are, in their way, voyeurs. And one day, I resolved to write about one.
Why did you think they were voyeurs?
You have to spend hours and hours. You have to keep awake for as long as you can, staring at rows of letters or figures behind which the enemy is talking to the enemy, and it is a form of voyeurism. And in many respects, Peeping Tom owes its birth to the extraordinary atmosphere in which we in SOE had to work. We were a very, very, very difficult body of people to know.
I hope you don't mind me talking a little bit about the ending of the film, but ever since I saw the film, I've always wanted to know about this. Do you mind if I give away the ending?
Of course not.
Each of the women in this movie who has been murdered has died with a horrified expression on her face. And the cops are wondering what they could possibly have seen that could account for this horrible expression, which is unlike the expression the cops have ever seen on corpses before. And we find out at the end that the reason why these women have this horrified expression on their faces when they die is that the filmmaker who's been filming them as he murders them has held up a mirror to them at the moment of their death. And so what they're seeing is the expression on their faces as he stabs them in the neck. And that's why they look so horrified, because they're watching their own murder. What a really weird thing to think of for a movie. How did you think of this? This is something that sticks with everybody who sees your film, I think.
Michael Powell,
the director of the film.
Yes, who was a genius. Michael Powell didn't know how this film ended. And when I went to tell it to him, neither did I. And there he was sitting with this camera face. And I was supposed to tell him how Peeping Tom was frightened to death. And he looked at me with these brilliant, obsessed camera eyes. And I was frightened myself and suddenly realized how Peeping Tom would kill his victims. And Michael Powell accepted it at once.
The film has so much to say about a certain kind of behavioral psychology, about voyeurism through the media. I'm wondering if you were exposed to behavioral psychology as a kid. If anybody was kind of charting your fears in the way this character's father charted his.
My father's only fears were that I would not become a bookseller. My mother's only fear was that I might marry out of the religion.
Right.
Fundamentally, SOE is a pretty good breeding ground for phobia and fear of every single kind.
Sure.
The atmosphere in a briefing room is frightening to those who have to conduct the briefing. And a study of fear emerged naturally.
Now, another theme that drifts through Peeping Tom is pornography, because what this character does for a living is take girls in erotic poses, take pictures of them to be sold under the counter at a local store. And I'm wondering, in the days when you frequented your father's bookstore, which was an antiquarian bookstore, if there were old, rare, erotic or pornographic texts that you had access to?
Oh, yes. The pornography was on the fourth floor, not very far away from the rare religious books. The pornography was of a very high order, indeed, and only very distinguished people were allowed up there. A certain member of the royal family practically had his throne there. Anyway, yes, I was allowed to see it. And I feel sometimes Peeping Tom did not do justice to its potential. But in those days, we had a censor to compete with. And fundamentally, Peeping Tom himself, fundamentally, only learnt what love is when he died. And that in itself is pornography, to have to go to those extremes to feel properly.
Martin Scorsese loves Peeping Tom. And I imagine that it was through Peeping Tom that he met you. He asked you to be the voice of Satan in his film The Last Temptation of Christ. And before I ask you about this, let's hear you as the voice of Satan. And you appear to Willem Dafoe, who's Christ in the film. Satan appears just as a flame, as a large flame, and you're the voice of the flame.
Archangel, move back. Move back, you're blinding me.
Jesus. I'm the one you've been waiting for. Remember, when you were a little boy, you cried, make me a god. God, God, make me a god.
But I was just a child then.
You are God. The Baptist knew it. Night's time, you admit it. You are his son, the only son of God.
Son of God.
Join me. Together we'll rule the living and the dead. You'll give life and you'll take life. You'll sit in judgment and I'll sit next to you. Imagine how strong we could be together.
Satan.
When Martin Scorsese asked you to be the voice of Satan, did he know that you were particularly interested in the occult in the days when you frequented your father's antiquarian bookstore?
I had a live answer phone at home, and he used to phone occasionally and talk, and suddenly had the idea, because I was coming to New York to see Helene Humph with my wife, perhaps you'd be the voice of Satan. When I read the script, I wished I were Satan, because I found the lines unsayable. But not knowing very much about Satan's dialogue, having left SOE years before, I did what I could with it. And when that session was over, made the great mistake of saying to Martin Scorsese, who I venerate, what are you going to do professionally? Which I hoped might get a laugh, but which I've yet to be forgiven. He is a genius, but I still believe The Last Temptation of Christ was one that should properly have been resisted.
The movie, you mean, making the movie?
I was the voice of the devil. I would like to be again, but not with that dialogue. No.
Do you enjoy going to bookstores now?
No.
Why?
Because the little boy who went every Saturday morning to 84 Chequers Road, and every Saturday afternoon was treated to the cinema, the little boy compares them all to the warmth, to the special features of the irreplaceable, now unknowable, 84 Charing Cross Road. I miss it.
Nothing measures up to that?
No. No, no. It was more than a bookshop. It was possible to see Charles Chaplin in one corner and J.B. Priestley in another, then Freud wandered in before he died, writing a book called Moses and Monotheism. And there was a prostitute right opposite the building who collected Rudyard Kipling and asked the manager to keep copies for her if it were a first edition. Well, she came back with the cash in about an hour. So it was a rich, rich, rich bookshop full of unexpected qualities. I miss that prostitute. She was a very adventurous woman with an extraordinarily attractive puppy. And she did appreciate Rudyard Kipling.
Leo Marx, thank you so much.
Goodbye now.
Leo Marx's World War II memoir is called Between Silk and Cyanide. This is Fresh Air.